Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back my great guest co-host, Dr. Elizabeth Parks. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing super. And part of it is because we get to talk with Dr. Myron Cohen today, director of the Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina, and one of the world's great experts about the worldwide spread of AIDS and other global threats to health. I'm really looking forward to that conversation.
Yeah, I think it'll be super interesting.
Yeah, there's some great, exciting innovations that he can talk about.
Can't wait.
First, we've got some interesting innovations in research that matters, and let's dive right in. Let's talk about the very first one, something called the BCG vaccination. Had you ever heard of that?
I've heard about it intermittently, but it's not very common in the United States.
Yeah, it's much more common in places around the world where rates of tuberculosis are still very high. And we should remember that tuberculosis still kills almost 2 million people a year. It's one of the leading causes of death worldwide. Mm-hmm. And this vaccination that was developed in 1947 called BCG, or Bacillus Calmette-Guerin. I hope I said that even close to being right. This could really help. It's not a perfect vaccination because it doesn't give lifelong immunity, but it is good and can be helpful.
Right. And fortunately, what this new study was showing was that it might actually have longer lasting effects than we previously thought.
Yeah, this was a study published in the International Journal of Epidemiology. And they were really kind of questioning whether countries where they were maybe whether they were going to continue vaccination or not, maybe should really continue doing it because it really lasts longer than they think and it can be very effective. I think that's, you know, important message, certainly in places where you don't have much of it and they're controlling tuberculosis through case finding, like in the United States, and testing those who immigrate or at high risk of getting TB. But the vaccination in many other places in the world apparently really can provide immunity for substantial portions of the population.
Exactly. And it sounds like if they target maybe babies in infancy where, you know, your risk of dying from tuberculosis is particularly high, you could have up to 20 years of lasting immunity that can cut your rate of infection possibly in half.
Yeah. So if you have relatives that are in different locations around the world where the vaccination is still being offered, I think recommend to those relatives. Good thing to get. Our next research that matter, I think, is concerning, and that is older men who get diagnosed with prostate cancer, do they get recommended a treatment more often if the doctors own the equipment that's actually doing that treatment?
Yeah, I thought this was kind of an interesting article to read and raise some possible ethical questions. So prostate cancer, as some of you may know, is actually very common in elderly men, but usually we think of it as being something that patients will kind of die with as opposed to die of. You know, it tends to have kind of a longer course and often goes untreated due to the potential kind of nasty side effects of treatment, such as impotence or incontinence that comes with prostate surgery.
And if you take elderly men with prostate cancer, some of them have at least a 75% chance of dying from something other than their cancer within 10 years. In this particular study, the researchers looked at 31,000 men aged 65 and older who were newly diagnosed, and they were seeing how many of them had gotten radiation, even if they were unlikely to live for the next 10 years and had higher odds of dying from something else. And then were they more likely to get this if the doctors owned the type of equipment? So in one set of practices, the doctors who owned the radiation equipment treated 53% of the men, whereas those who didn't have any financial incentive treated 44%. Maybe those numbers aren't large, but that is maybe 20% higher if you had the equipment, suggesting there could be a financial consideration in addition to the science. I don't know.
Right. I mean, that is what that is suggesting, and I think it's a good idea that, you know, you can always get a second opinion to see if another physician would offer the same type of treatment.
You know, they also looked at a very intensely modulated radiation therapy, a newer treatment, IMRT, and supposedly to target the tissue. And in this case, if the doctors had an ownership stake in this IMRT, 42% of the men with a high chance of dying from something other than their cancer received the treatment, compared to 26% of those who didn't own it. Again, in that particular case, that's almost a 40% elevated risk. So it raises fundamental questions. This came out of the University of Michigan. And I think, you know, one of the questions would be is if you are recommended radiation therapy and you're elderly man, you know, it might not be a bad idea. It couldn't hurt you to get a second opinion.
No, I don't think so. I think that'd be perfectly within your rights as a patient.
And also just find out, are there any financial stakes? I think in a lot of these cases, there wasn't a financial interest, and yet this was still recommended. So it may well be the recommended treatment here. But let's remove this financial set of if we can from the consideration. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I do too.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters. And this is a major success story, but it's the first gene therapy for leukemia, a very common form, probably one of the most common forms of childhood leukemia, called acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And for patients with that childhood cancer who do not respond to standard treatment or who've suffered relapses.
Fortunately, children with ALL typically respond very well to treatment, and there's pretty high cure rates. But unfortunately, in those patients who don't respond to initial therapy, it now seems like there's this new hope, this medicine called, how do we decide to call it? Kymriah, I think.
Or Kymria.
Kymria, maybe.
Either way.
That is actually using your body's own immune system to fight back against the cancer.
Yeah, they have this. They take your T cells from your own body and then they genetically modify them in the laboratory to attack and kill the leukemic cells. And this is called CART T cell therapy because these cells are infused back into the body. And it clearly can induce remission within 3 months in 83% of the patients who were treated in the trial, though it was only based on 63 patients. But based on that, the FDA approved it. Sounds great. What's the concern?
I mean, there's a few concerns. There's a risk of concern with retransfusion of these modified T cells that can cause kind of a massive immune reaction in the body, which is why this treatment is only being offered at a select number of sites that are equipped to kind of handle that type of adverse or bad reaction. And the other major concern, unfortunately, is the cost of this treatment, which is quite substantial.
Quite substantial. $50,000? $100,000?
Yeah.
$150,000?
Oh.
$250,000?
Getting closer. I'm going to give it to you. It's $475,000 per treatment.
Wow. But I guess to their defense or not, the company says they're only going to require payment from those who respond to treatment, which I think that helps a little bit. I mean, you know, I think that's a good start. And they say no one who can't afford it will not get it, which I think is another good thing. But it does sound expensive.
Yeah, it does. And hopefully they work out a way to make it accessible to everyone who really needs this treatment.
Yeah. I think the idea of this new genetically modified T cells maybe offers promise for lots of other cancers. We're really excited about that.
Yeah, it's super exciting medicine.
Talk about last research that matters, which is just something unusual, but it's kind of the sequencing of all 24 human chromosomes and maybe detecting genetic disorders that may explain unexplained miscarriage and abnormalities during pregnancy.
Yeah, this is an interesting article. I was pretty excited to read it because in providing prenatal care to expecting mothers, the decision of whether or not to test for genetic abnormalities can be pretty difficult for people and is obviously accentuated by getting a positive result, whether it's truly positive or not.
And this research, which was published in the journal Science Translational Medicine, was kind of looking at, you know, typically you screen for the chromosomes 21, 18, 13, and Down syndrome. But like you said, it could be a false positive result. And they were looking at samples over 72,000 from the United States and almost 17,000 from Australia. And they were looking at the likelihood that one of these samples was abnormal and how this may translate into one of these rare diseases. And again, suggesting that this may offer better ways of precisely identifying what the problems were in these high-risk outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was finding a way to be more specific in our diagnosis of possible genetic abnormalities in expectant moms. They suggest that maybe everyone should be offered this treatment, but that to me seems like it might be a little excessive.
Yeah, I think these are questions that are going to certainly come up more and more, and I think this technology is probably moving its way into more mainstream medicine. I think this is something that you may want to ask your doctor about, OBGYN or family doctor who's following you if you are pregnant, if you've had a miscarriage. Certainly be aware of this research and can ask about it.
Yeah, and certainly if you had a positive screening test as well.
Yep, great. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Myron Cohen, Director of the University of North Carolina Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases, about the worldwide work of AIDS prevention and treatment and other global threats to health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Elizabeth Parks. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Elizabeth Parks. Today on Conversations, Elizabeth, we're talking with Dr. Myron Cohen, Director of the Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina, about his worldwide work and success against the spread of AIDS and other global threats to health. Welcome back to Your Health, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you back. It's been a number of years now, and the challenges facing global spread, global control of HIV have not lessened, but maybe there's been some successes, then we're going to talk about those. But the threats to global health have continued. Tell us, what's a typical day in the life of Dr. Cohen like? Tell us how you really got passionate about this topic, because you are a recognized worldwide leader.
Well, they're two separate questions. The typical day is probably like a day like any other day for everybody else, except I'm probably going somewhere, and I'm worried about the weather. Okay, so the features, and I'm very neurotic about, am I going to make this flight, and is the flight going to get there? Because to do this kind of work, you travel a lot, like 100,000, 200,000 miles a year of travel. UNC has research sites in Malawi, Zambia, China, Vietnam, Nicaragua, South Africa. I may not have named them all. So, and we tend to visit these sites and see the faculty and staff who are working at these sites. So there's a lot of travel. So I'm usually out of town 2 weeks a month for that purpose. And then the typical day in town, I really like smoked fish. So I'll usually start with some sort of smoked fish, which I'm sure is, from a family medicine point of view, is terrible for you, but it's not every day.
Well, we know it tastes good.
Small concentrations of smoked fish, followed by yogurt, and then followed by trying to discharge the various responsibilities here for UNC, which are research-oriented, clinically oriented, and then responsibilities to NIH, where I am one of the people running an NIH network called the Prevention Trials Network, which has 77 sites worldwide. So there's endless conference calls all day long.
So you're on the phone, you're moving all day long.
Today, for example, I taught one course and then I was on the phone for the entire rest of the day.
Wow.
So it's busy. And then we see patients at different points in time here in Chapel Hill and so on and so forth.
Yeah, great.
I know one of the places that you've traveled a lot and had a big impact is in Malawi with the joint UNC Project Malawi. I'm wondering if you could tell us why you chose Malawi or how that place has been significant to you.
Right. Well, Malawi chose us. So what happened? How did this actually happen? So you'd have to follow the trajectory of the AIDS epidemic, and it was in 1981 we saw our first cases of HIV in Chapel Hill. And we had a big epidemic because we were managing so many hemophiliacs. So about 20% of the admissions to UNC were for HIV in 1985. That really galvanized the growth of infectious disease here, HIV research, and so on and so forth. We also had Burroughs Wellcome here, and they developed the first drug for HIV, AZT. So the combination of the volume of patients with HIV and drug discovery in the triangle acted as a giant catalyst for the growth of HIV research in Chapel Hill. So now to your question. In 1989, we became partners on a very large, one of the largest USAID grants called AIDS Cap. And the goal of that, in the absence of all that we know now, all those 30 years ago, was to prevent HIV with very simple tools. Condoms, behavior change, treating other sexually transmitted diseases. And each of the partners, and there were three partners really, each was assigned different countries, and Malawi was assigned to us. And that's how we got involved in Malawi. And then I was able to hire people that could work in Malawi, and everything grew organically over the years. And just to be a little long-winded about it, so we just started out with very small projects, and we were very interested in preventing transmission of HIV. But we were not just clinical investigators, we were also biologists. So we were able to really quickly build kind of a biology program of understanding the fundamental issues of transmission of HIV. And that biology program exists to this day with the same grants. I have the same grant now that I had in 1990 to study the biology of transmission of HIV. And other grants got piled on. And then the remarkable thing was the other UNC faculty. So as we were doing this research and focused really on HIV, people heard about it on the faculty. And then an ENT surgeon named Carol Shores decided she and Anthony Charles would start a surgery training program because there were no surgeons, basically, very few surgeons. There was no training of surgeons in Malawi. So they started a successful training program. Matt Ewan, the neurosurgeon, decided to go and put shunts in and went in the summer and put shunts in and so on and so forth. So, and then a burn unit was built by Johnson & Johnson and Anthony Charles. So if you look at the Malawi UNC Project Malawi now, which started out with one person, Irving Hoffman, it's now got, I think, 8 to 12 full-time faculty living in Malawi and maybe 300 staff. And it's quite remarkable, and it's very inspiring because it wasn't like we cajoled people. Everyone voted with their feet to participate in ways that were appropriate to their interests.
So you mentioned multiple other countries. What's the most recent country, and how did that relationship come about, and what are y'all working on?
Yeah, each country is different. Okay, so China, we work on sexually transmitted diseases and especially syphilis, which is a really big problem in China still. And then Zambia is a women's health program where our Department of Obstetrics is devoted to improving women's health in Zambia, led by Jeff and Elizabeth Stringer. The most recent country is Vietnam. So based on research we had done in heterosexual couples, where we showed that if you treat an infected person, you render them no longer contagious. Investigators in Chapel Hill said, does this work for people who inject drugs where the transmission route is not sexual? It's by a different route. But there was a big belief that people who inject drugs would be too unreliable to participate in a program where daily pills were essential. So we started a site in Vietnam led by, and we had reason to do this because Vivian Go, a woman in public health, is a very prominent investigator. She'd worked in Vietnam for years and years. And so we went to her and said, can we start a site in Vietnam for this kind of research? We also do this study called HPTN, HIV Prevention Trial 084, in Ukraine and Indonesia. But the trial is just completed, and the rumors are that it was a big success. I haven't seen any of the data yet. But so Vietnam, because of HIV prevention in people who inject drugs. Then the NIH saw the site and how successful it was, and they asked others in our group to start working on other things, tuberculosis, treatment of HIV, and the broader population. And I'm going to Vietnam in a couple of weeks, actually.
So it's interesting. You're able to operate in the world of infectious diseases across governments and across healthcare systems. It's a model for how to perhaps tackle things collaboratively.
Yeah, we're always partners with the local governments or the country governments. So you have to be culturally sensitive and follow a lot of kind of guidelines in your mind and in order to be successful.
Yeah, I've heard that with global health, one of the kind of biggest barriers, obviously, buy-in with the local population. And what other strategies have you implemented to make global health sustainable so that if at what time UNC leaves or you eventually retire, how that work can continue?
Raising the issue of sustainability is critical. When you don't do that, you're doing what's called parachute research, right? Mm-hmm. You realize there's a population with a problem. You jump in there without a lot of connections and you jump out. We've been pretty diametrically opposed to that for our entire time. So the devices we've used are pretty specific. Sustainability depends almost entirely on training people locally that are not available when we start, who replace us and with whom we have ongoing relationships, but they're well-trained, they're loyal to the site and the country, and they're going to take over and they're going to get paid. So we spend an inordinate amount of time first on the training programs. So I can't tell you how many people we've trained. I mean, hundreds from resource-constrained countries at all different levels, not all PhDs, not all MDs, but some advanced training. There's almost never a time we don't have somebody here from one of these countries training, and they can be getting a master's degree or just here for a short time to learn a procedure and so on and so forth. And we've done this for 30 years. Then they go home. But if they go home, there has to be a career path. These countries generally don't have a career path, and the place where people go wrong is believing that they can just train them and throw them out of the world because they'll be in Rocky Mount next week, you know. And I say that because that's the only trainee we lost moved to Rocky Mount, a physician trainee with very well trained and moved to Rocky Mount. And that was a source of – and we're still trying to convince them to go back, right? We never stop saying go home to Malawi. So when we started, there's 8 million people, let's say, roughly. There were something like 80 physicians in the entire country. And there's no oncologist. We have the only oncologist in the country, and I can come back to that in a second. Satish Gopal. There was no surgery training program. There was no internal medicine training program. And we became partners with the College of Medicine, which is Blantyre, very early. And it's been kind of a road, you know. So to answer your question, sustainability depends on the human connections, on a long-range plan, and on the training of people who are in country that are your collaborators forever. And I still have the same collaborators. There's nowhere we work where I don't have the same collaborators. Some are a little older than me, but
we're going to need to take a short break, and when we come back, we really want to understand a little bit more about the research. You received some really great recognition, Breakthrough Scientist of the Year, some really amazing, innovative research, and I know we'd like to talk with that. But we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Myron Cohen, Director of the University of North Carolina Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases, about his worldwide work against the spread of AIDS and other global threats to health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Elizabeth Parks. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Myron Cohen, Director of the Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases at the University of North Carolina. And we've been talking right before the break about your worldwide work, the human connections, the training, the relationships that are on the ground and that are really one of the most meaningful things to you. Let's talk a little bit about your research. You really were noted as the Breakthrough Scientist of the Year. Tell us a little bit about what you're involved in now that's exciting.
Right. So the first issue is, for any disease, you can treat it, prevent it, and cure it. Of course, prevention, especially for people in family medicine, is everything, right? We do so much, have so many efforts to prevent disease. So it wasn't surprising that when HIV surfaced and there was no treatment, the prevention became paramount. And it turned out, contrary to beliefs, that it would be very difficult to make a vaccine. And even now, we don't have a vaccine. We have strategies, and maybe we'll get to the end of that. I'll tell you the latest strategy in a few minutes, which we're involved in. But we don't have a vaccine. So in the absence of a vaccine, you need to do something else. And the something else we did were fairly successful but hard to measure. We tried to change human behavior. We tried to get people to use more condoms. We tried to treat STDs other than HIV very aggressively to reduce inflammation that precipitates the transmission of HIV. But none of that was enough, and the epidemic kept growing and growing and growing. So our group from the very beginning was interested in one little thing. Really, not rocket science. We were interested in whether if you treat somebody, you render them less contagious. It makes sense. That's how we deal with tuberculosis, right? They come in the hospital for a few days, they get their pills, they take their pills under supervision, and they're not contagious. But what was not known was the magnitude of the benefit and the durability of the benefit. So I set out to try and devise a study. First, to understand what drugs might do this, because I wouldn't assume every drug for HIV could do this. It had to have a few side effects and so on and so forth. So we spent about 10 years working on the drug problem with many investigators around the campus, especially Angela Kashub in the School of Pharmacy. And it was exciting research. Around 2000, we had enough information after 10 years to say we're ready to try and do a clinical trial. But the ethics of the trial are very complicated because we needed discordant couples, one person positive, the other negative. We needed ethically to understand if we treated the infected person, we would stop the transmission to the next person. But we also needed a control group, and that's very complicated. So we spent a lot of time on the ethics of all this. And in the end of the day, we ended up with a study called HPTN, HIV Prevention Trial number 052. And that trial, which has got its own Wikipedia site, enrolled 1,763 couples at 13 sites in 9 countries.
Wow.
And that study went on only very shortly. It was interrupted because what happened was we demonstrated very quickly after 18 months that treatment abrogates transmission. And that observation that the magnitude was so great changed worldwide policy just about overnight. So U.S. guidelines changed to be universal test and treat. You'll remember in your younger days you rationed HIV therapy. That all went away right after these results were released. And then later that year, as you point out, it wasn't the actual thing is Science Magazine has the most important discovery across all fields for a year with 9 runner-ups. So they awarded, on the cover, they put this research and said, this is the most important discovery in science in 2011, which is like kind of winning Dancing with the Stars. I mean, it's an impossible, in all candor, it's never been on this campus before and it may never be again, unless we're very lucky. The runner-up, the cover that was supposed to be, was a spaceship that the Japanese built to go to an asteroid. It cost $2 billion in 35 years, and it came back after 35 years. So I'm quite sure there were consternation in another country that this little clinical trial received so much attention. But it did have a big impact on public health policy and treatment worldwide. So treatment guidelines really quickly changed, not to ration the drugs, but to treat people, because we also demonstrated that immediate treatment was much better for your health. So you had two things moving in the same direction. There was no dichotomy. You stop transmission, you improve your health. It was a no-brainer. And eventually, virtually every country on the planet went to UTT, Universal Test and Treat. Subsequently, UNAIDS made the centerpiece of HIV prevention on a planetary basis a program called 90-90-90. Find 90% of the people infected through testing, get 90% linked to care, suppress viremia in 90% with a model that makes the epidemic go away. And in fact, in many countries, the epidemics are shrinking, shrinking, shrinking. You asked what we're doing now. So the next thing to do was to look at population-level studies. And so the HIV Prevention Trials Network is actually doing a study of 2 million people in Zambia and South Africa to understand if immediate treatment actually has the expected impact. And other investigators are doing similar studies. And then we moved on to other biological interventions, vaccine development, using ART, antiviral therapy for people who are HIV negative called pre-exposure prophylaxis, using monoclonal antibodies to inform vaccine development and to prevent HIV, and all those things are going on.
Yeah. And meanwhile, you came out with a new study on injectable therapy.
And the network, right. We came out with the studies in the field. In fact, just today, there's more than 500 people enrolled in that study. So we've taken a commercial product that a drug company is developing. ViiV is developing a product called cabotegravir. And we've said that one of the problems with people trying to prevent HIV with a pill is they can't take the pill every day.
Sure.
And this is well known from the contraceptive field. Some people who are challenged in that way might prefer an injection that lasts 8 weeks.
Yep.
And so we've piloted the stuff. We've shown it's safe in another study, and now it's moving through a clinical trial in men, and a clinical trial in women will start in October. We'll start a trial in October. Now, let me emphasize, this sounds so totally narcissistic. I obviously don't do, I'm a cheerleader for 99% of this, right? As a leader, other people are actually doing this. One should not take credit for the work of thousands of other people.
Sure.
Although I'd like to.
Sure, we understand.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about this injectable kind of prophylaxis, if you will. My understanding of PrEP is that currently the regimen is 2 medications, and this new cabotegravir, if that's how you say it, is a single agent.
Correct.
So is the thought that patients will have to take another medicine in addition to this, or that the one might be effective enough?
So the combination of tenofovir and FTC, that's the Truvada combination. We use it therapeutically, and that was the first combination tested for PrEP in humans. It worked very well in men. It worked less well in women, as far as we can tell. And that's a complicated discussion. The drug we're talking about now has a much higher barrier to resistance. It's called an integrase inhibitor. And those integrase inhibitors, it's hard for a bug to become resistant. And it's very potent. So it lasts a very long time after the injection, the way that it's milled to last 8 weeks. It's in a nano suspension. So we anticipate, so the studies we're doing are actually, one of them is a non-inferiority study. That is, it's going to be no worse than the pills. The other study in women is a superiority study. It's going to be better for women than the pills. So we're very excited.
Yeah, no. Well, it's interesting because you're working globally, but yet there are lessons probably locally, and I'm sure there's vice versa. What do you learn that you bring back from your global travels that you say, these are things and lessons that we really need to apply throughout our training, throughout our education, and then what do you take with you globally? I mean, how does this local global
really
work?
They're not split, and it's hard for people to see that. When I was in Africa this summer with the chancellor, and I showed her a clinic in a very poor country, Malawi, where the discoveries that it made had changed policies worldwide. Right? How can these 250 people living in Malawi contribute so vastly to everything changing all over the world? Now, conversely, we learn things in Africa that we bring back to the United States pretty readily. Like in North Carolina, we're very concerned about the growth of clusters of people with HIV. It's not random. They grow like a tree or a bush based on networks. And we use molecular phylogeny, that is the connection of viruses, to study the networks. We do that in Africa through a partnership with the Gates Foundation, and we do it in North Carolina with our partnership with the state. And all the tools are the same, and all the thinking's the same. None of it's any different. In the United States, there's a tremendous fear about resistant gonorrhea. You can't not read about like the idea that the superbug is coming and we'll have untreatable gonorrhea. I think that must be rife in family medicine.
Yeah.
But in fact, we're about to do a trial in Malawi to prove that we have alternative drugs that could be used to treat gonorrhea under FDA IND approval. Why Malawi? Because we're seeing like 1,000 cases of gonorrhea a month or every other month in our clinic in Malawi. So again, we have so many things happen, and the boundaries are not as you see them. We go to the place where we're going to be able to do the research fastest to inform the entire species. China and syphilis is like that for us.
So we're going to have to wrap up in just a second, but I guess one final question is, what do you see for yourself and for the work you're doing in the next year?
I would love for that injectable study to be stopped because the stuff is so good. So when you're doing a study, you get no results. It's all under a data safety monitoring board. But that the injectable cabotegravir may be so good that the oversight board will stop it and say, this is better than the alternative. That would be thrilling to me. I'll look forward to seeing the population-level benefits of the 052 study, treating people immediately, seeing what happens in villages all over Southern Africa. We'll have those results at the end of 2019, roughly. The challenge for me is almost that there are too much pressure to keep moving faster ever forward. The antibody studies we're doing, there are a lot of other antibodies, and we're under pressure to start studying additional antibodies, even though we haven't finished the first antibody. And so I was on the phone today saying, well, you know, don't we need to wait for these results first? Should we really move forward in any way? And it's a debate, you know, because we're faster, forward. I tell you, there's no better career than infectious diseases. It's always interesting. It's always compelling. Nothing better for a cocktail party or a radio show.
Well, I know you have heard the saying that if you save one life, it's as if you've saved the entire world. So I think we just, on behalf of your health listeners, we have to thank you and your colleagues around the world for saving lives. Well, we want to thank you for being with us today, Dr. Myron Cohen, Director of the Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases. And we're going to take a short break, but then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Elizabeth Parks. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Elizabeth, we're going to spend a few minutes listening to health questions and concerns from our listeners. If they have a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call.
I'm in my early 50s, and I'm considering a facelift. What do you think about the risks of this procedure?
You know, I think that's a really good question, and it's not something that perhaps we would think about as much as primary care physicians. What sort of things with any type of surgery, but in particular maybe facial surgery, would you think about, Elizabeth?
Right. I think with any surgery, you have to be concerned about the risk of infection during the procedure or possible bleeding. So if you're older and maybe on blood thinners, might not be the best idea. Obviously, you know, there's also a lot of sensitive structures in the face, our muscles and our nerves that help us talk and eat and make facial expressions, and you'd have to be careful for those during a facelift procedure.
Yeah, because you are going to cut some nerves, and you could have risk of what we would call three different types of nerve effects, what's called paresthesias, which you know as
kind of numbness or tingling in the nerve distribution. Yeah.
Dysesthesia, which is this painful area. Sometimes the paresthesias could not be as painful, but this dysesthesia, where it's just really kind of painful. And then our anesthesia.
Yeah, feeling nothing.
Feeling nothing. All of which may be bothersome and may or may not be permanent. A lot of times these things are not. You could have this paralysis of one of the muscles that could cause paralysis on the face. Again, these are rarer, but your plastic surgeon, the ear, nose, and throat, whoever's doing the facelift procedure should discuss those complications. In addition to which, you may need a fair amount of lidocaine, numbing medicine. And if you had some sort of heart condition, you probably would want to discuss how much lidocaine is safe for you to take.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My wife and I have been trying to get pregnant for a little over a year. At what point should we start considering fertility treatments? And if we do, what's the first step?
Well, I know infertility is one of the more common issues for which people both is frustrating and difficult emotionally and can be an expensive workup and a process. So I think I appreciate that question, and we can talk a little bit about that.
For most people, if you're still having difficulty conceiving at 12 months, that's an appropriate time to kind of seek additional help with a physician or with a fertility specialist. It's actually advised to seek help even earlier, after maybe 6 months of difficulty conceiving, if you're a woman over the age of 35. One of the first things we do is just concentrate kind of on the effectiveness of our attempts. So timing of intercourse with ovulation and paying attention to ovulatory symptoms can be beneficial.
There was an interesting study about 8,500 infertile couples kind of trying to figure out what was causing this. And a female factor, perhaps not ovulating or perhaps a problem with the uterus or maybe a scar tissue, was 37% of the time a problem. A male factor, like the sperm not being functional or being able to impregnate, was 8%. A male and female at the same time actually was 35%. 5% they couldn't figure it out, which means most of the times you can. And guess what? It happened in 15% during this time of the study.
I think they eventually got pregnant.
That's right.
Congratulations.
So sometimes it's just a matter of time. And you need some kind of emotional support because, again, this can ultimately be very expensive, time-consuming. But I would say that there are a lot more options for people now and a lot more experience with some of the medications that are out there than they've been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So I encourage you to go see someone who perhaps specializes in this type of treatment.
Great. And good luck.
And good luck. What's our very last house call?
It's almost time for all of the marketing for this year's flu shots to start. The past few years, it doesn't seem like they've been that effective. In fact, I had a coworker get a horrible case of the flu even after they got their shot. Honestly, is it really worth it?
Well, you know, this is one of those interesting things that people seem to have strong opinions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure the opinions are totally linked to the science, or maybe they are, but it seems like a lot of people really do believe in flu shots and also understand that they may or may not get infected in a given year, but if they get a flu shot, they have lower their risk of getting infected.
We want to break this question down into a few parts. I think talking about efficacy is important. It is true that the flu vaccine varies in how it protects you each year, and that's based on how much the virus changes each year. And that's not something we can always predict, unfortunately. However, it does seem like it's actually pretty effective. So in the last year, it protected against 50% of influenza cases, which is a pretty significant reduction for such a common virus.
Yeah, and you might say, well, that didn't protect me 50% of the time. And I guess you don't know which group you're going to be in that circumstance. And certainly if you are elderly, if you have asthma, if you have underlying immune suppression, your risk, heart disease, you would say your risk is really higher, and your risk if you get the flu could be catastrophic, right? If you're pregnant, a young child, these are the age groups in which we really do try to get as best as we can universal vaccination.
Right. To a young, healthy person, influenza might not seem like that big of a deal, but to those at-risk populations, it can be really severe with pneumonia or sometimes even death. So if you are young, healthy, you can take one for the team, get a vaccine, and help protect those other people in your life.
I think it's worthwhile to at least make sure that your provider is getting the vaccination, even if you didn't get it. Yeah. Lower your chance. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of you for listening to Your Health. We hope we've answered questions that are important to your health. If you want to send us your own story or question, email us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search for our health app, Your Health, one word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. I want to thank my guest co-host, Dr. Elizabeth Parks, and our guest today, Dr. Myron Cohn. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Elizabeth Parks.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.